The Outdoorsman Radio Show is brought to you by Ellis Outdoors, LLC. This is Talk Radio 680 WCBM. Time now for the Outdoorsman Radio Show with your host, Alan Ellis.
Good morning, everyone. Again, this is Alan Ellis on the Youth Turkey Day, when a week away from the opening of the trophy striped bass season. We're also less than a week away from the opener for the spring gobbler season on the 18th. But we have with us today our friend, Harry Hornick, who is the striped bass guy, the guru for striped bass. And Harry joins us now on the hotline. Good morning, Harry. How are you?
Good morning, Al. How are you doing?
Doing great. Yourself?
Thanks for having me on.
Yes, sir. My pleasure. My pleasure. So,
and, I got to point out, well, number one, thanks for having me on.
Yeah.
Number two, want to point out that, I mean, there are a lot of striped bass gurus at DNR.
That's true.
There's a bunch of them. There's a bunch of people that, over the years, Harley Spear, Steve Early, Nick Carter, you know, Dale Weinrich even.
And who?
Luca Kovac. There are people that all have worked on striped bass.
Dale Weinrich.
So,
that guy.
Even Dale did some work. So, but there's a lot of good people there now, and I am in charge of, like, the current striped bass program. Some of those folks, well, all of those folks, the biologists are out in the field now as we speak, sampling on the spawning grounds. And I'm also in charge of, like, the Access Point Angler Intercept survey, the APIS folks, the
right.
folks that interview recreational fishermen at piers and off the charter boats and on head boats for Maryland. So,
well,
those folks are doing striped bass work also.
Well, I'm glad I got you talking a little bit about the program and the people behind it. You know, I have nothing but respect for those folks who have the boots on the ground that do the research, the people that go out there and do the Young of the Year survey and, you know, do all the data and the APHIS folks that you talked about. I mean, it's just, you know, it's got to be a passion of theirs to continue to do that. And I've always touted Maryland's Department of Natural Resources for its basis in science for our wildlife management here and our fisheries management here. So, you know, it does me good and our listeners good to hear directly from you about, sharing the glory with your coworkers, which you well should, and they should be celebrating the fact that we have a recovered fishery here in Maryland with the striped bass, given, you know, the 6-year moratorium back in the 80s, and here we are again planning our next trophy season. So, just wanted to pass that on.
No, appreciate that.
My pleasure. So here's the rumor: Virginia closed their trophy season, and Maryland's next, and there's going to be a moratorium, and we're killing all the cow rockfish, and we're rockfish is in big trouble. You are here to dispel all the rumors and let us know the true facts. First off, our opener for first off, we have a catch and release season that started back on, I guess, the first part of March. And what are we hearing from that?
Well, I mean, people are going out catch and release. As of right now, there are no changes to the season that's, you know, the catch and release is going on right now.
Right.
I know some people have said, hey, you know, we're not going to do it, and that's their choice. I mean.
Yeah, okay. I've never been a proponent of it, as you know. I've never been in favor of that, but you know, I don't participate in it, never have. Not saying I never would, just to see what it's about. But again, I just don't. It's not my thing.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
So I'm not participating.
Yeah.
But there are those who do it, and they do it well. They do it with light tackle. They know where to go and what you know, what to use, and hopefully they treat the fish with respect, and you know, everything is fine. And I know we've heard from, you know, Rudy Lukakovich a few times on water temperature and catch and release and the, you know, the circle hooks and so forth. So, you know, we know that it's possible to have that season and not be detrimental to the fish. It's just not in my nature to do that. So anyway, I take it. I'm hearing that it's not as popular as it once was. Am I hearing that correctly?
Well, I'm not sure about being popular, but we're gonna, you know, get into more of the results of it.
Yeah, sure.
But I mean, there is a lot of pressure on striped bass coast wide. I mean,
yes.
I mean, the management process looks at striped bass on a coastal basis, and you know, a lot of folks have you know, been commenting for years that, you know, oh, it's really bad. And believe it or not, you'll find people that, again, depending where you're at, that say that, hey, I've had great fishing. I don't know what everybody's talking about. And it really comes down to where, you know, where people are on the coast and in the bay. And, I mean, this kind of situation complicates the management efforts because, again, people, you know, people are hearing that it's that the last 10 years that there is been a decline in spawning stock biomass. And that is pretty much, I mean, that has happened. You know, the department, you know, is concerned about that. And, but, you know, as to what comes next, I mean, immediately we're going to have our trophy season.
Right.
There's no reason not to have it.
Right.
I mean, we are going to have it. You know, it is going to start next week. The regular season that starts after the trophy season, as it is right now, should be, you know, as scheduled. And, you know, we're going to go back to the circle hooks, the 19-inch minimum size. And, you know, the department spent a lot of effort last year, you know, promoting the use of circle hooks, promoting, you know, safe handling, you know, trying to minimize, you know, the effects of catch and release, you know,
right,
during the recreational season.
Right.
And then that gets us into, you know, what you know, we talk about, you know, the state's concerned about the, you know, the downward trend, but, you know, the problem that we feel that we need to look at and is being looked at by ASMSC and the other states is, like, the very large amount of dead discards, the fish that are caught and released.
Right.
I mean, there's so many fish caught on the East Coast, you know, combined in this fishery that it's just, like I said, it's just kind of, you know, for people to say we need a moratorium, that's, I mean, we're so far above the
threshold.
With regard to a moratorium, I mean,
right.
We're nowhere near where we were in the early 80s and during the moratorium. I mean, the stock is so much healthier. We're just, you know, we have so many good year classes that are spawning. We're still getting, you know, in the past 5 years, we've actually had good, you know, the good juvenile survey you mentioned. You're familiar
with
that.
Yeah, sure.
We've had, you know, above average recruitment in the last 5 years, three of the last 5 years, you know, good years.
Yeah, if I'm looking at the numbers correctly, what led up to the moratorium in, I believe, 80, was it 84? I can't remember.
85.
85, okay.
So, 85 to 1990.
Right. So, yeah. So we had small spawning success in 80, 81, 83, 85.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Then continued to 88 and 1990, and that is when the massive restocking effort started with the hatchery fish and the tagged fish and how many of those fish are returning and that type of thing. And that's when we really took an interest in how to get this fishery recovered. And it came back, you said 1990, I believe, is when you said we had our first season?
Right, reopened in 1990.
Okay. Then after that, then we had above-average year classes, 93, 96, and then we get into the 21st century, 2001, 3, 4, 5, 7, 11, and 15, we had above average year classes of recruitment. So,
yeah.
You know, it's, and now, I think you've said it without saying it, we've leveled off as far as our spawning success, but the catching coast-wide has increased, I guess, because of the fish, because of the recovered fishery. But now we've got another problem with the dead fish that are being released, or the fish that are dying after being released.
Is that
summarized kind of what you've said here?
Yeah, I mean, it's you've done your homework.
Well, thank you. Yeah. I try.
Yeah, so. We've been around the block before, though, so that's...
Yeah, well, every now and then, yeah. So.
But, yeah, I mean, we've had, I mean, you know, there are also issues with, you know, you mentioned that period of time where you had growth of the fishery, peak harvest in, like, 2004, 2006, those were, like, just tremendous years for recreational fishing.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's kind of dropped off since then. Mm-hmm. And
you're talking angler participation dropping off or success?
No, just the harvest itself.
Oh, the harvest itself.
Yeah, okay. Recreational harvest dropped off, like, you know, after, like, the mid 2000s.
Right.
I mean, not a crazy decline, but just kind of a drop off. I mean,
well, I think some of that's weather related too.
Some of it is. Some of it is just, I mean, fishing, the fish move, you know, you hear people talking now about, oh, well, the fish have just moved offshore. I mean, they're highly migratory. They move quite a bit. Something that Maryland anglers have in their favor is the fact that, you know, 70-90% of the striped bass, you know, we talk about, again, striped bass being managed on a coastal basis. Well, 70 to 90% of those fish spawn in Chesapeake Bay.
Right.
Use this as their nursery area, and once they're 19 inches, they're available to our anglers.
Right.
So it's we're definitely, you know, in a good spot as far as, like, you know, the with regard to the population biology and the fish being, you know, being available to us, to Maryland anglers.
Sure. Sure. Can we talk? I don't want to throw you a curveball. I mean, I've got all these numbers and so forth as far as regulations and some of the information that, you know, we talked about prior to the show airing and the, you know, that type of thing. What, you know, we see all these efforts, clean up the bay, and, you know, we got to deal with this pollution in the bay. We got to deal with these dead zones. And, you know, I mean, there's this panic stricken campaign, from some groups out there to, generate funding because there's a crisis in the Chesapeake Bay. But here we have, you know, record class, record or high reproduction on our Chesapeake Bay and the striped bass, you know, and oh, everything's a problem now. Silt's a problem and the oxygen's a problem. How big of a problem are the environmental factors to the recruitment of Chesapeake Bay? I mean, this is a big system that is like flushing a toilet twice a day, you know, with the incoming and outgoing tides. How big of a water quality problem are we dealing with in regard to striped bass, Harry?
Well, I can't say I know the number for, like, you know, how water quality, you know, specifically affects our bass, how habitat specifically addresses striped bass or any species in the bay. But, I mean, we do know that they all do. I mean, we do know that you need a healthy bay. I mean, fish,
right.
You know, fish can move out of a low oxygen zone, but where do they move to? They have to move to somewhere that is suitable for them.
Sure.
So, you know, as a biologist or an ecologist or a scientist, I mean, you get all those three groups of people, and they're going to say, hey, you know, water quality is important, and maybe not just for striped bass, for other species or other
sure,
species
sure.
of animals. You know, habitat, available habitat, spawning area, you know, degradation of areas. So, I mean, I can't give you a number like, oh, what affects them this percentage, but we do know that it affects them. And we do know, you know, years past, you know, there was, you know, the Chesapeake Bay Foundation, you know, they wanted, hey, you know, you got to improve the bay, you got to do this, you got to do that. And then they grade the bay. And, you know, over the last 25, 30 years, you know, things have gotten better. And again, having suitable habitat, having a healthy ecosystem, I mean, it just makes sense that that's what you want to have. I mean, if you look at areas that don't have as nice a conditions off of Broome's Island versus Inner Harbor, I mean, you have, and no offense to Inner Harbor folks.
No, of course.
But you have two different systems there, and, you know, one is again, not try to bash Baltimore or any of the cities, but, you know, water quality is important. Water quality does affect.
You have an outdated, look, Harry, yeah. People are afraid to say this, but we have such an outdated sewer system in Baltimore City that there's potential for all types of raw sewage dumps, and they happen. Every time there's a thunderstorm, they happen, and it dumps right out of the sewage system into the Chesapeake Bay, into the Inner Harbor, and then gets out into the Chesapeake Bay. We have such industry surrounding Curtis Creek. God knows what's being pumped into the water there. And, you know, it just... You know, you're not being prejudicial when you're targeting the city. It's happening. It's a big contributor to, and you don't have to comment on this. This is my opinion. It's happening on a daily basis where the water quality coming out of the city is being degraded. And it's any that way with any municipality.
Right. Feeding any large city is going to have that problem.
Right.
You know, the good thing is, though, is that, you know, our Chesapeake Bay, you know, large rivers, I mean, they're kind of resilient. I mean, they can handle things like that.
That's true.
They can, you know, you mentioned, you know, I don't want to say flushing a household item, but, you know, the flushing of the bay helps to, you know, to mix the water up to...
No, that's true. Yeah.
Change things. So, I mean, the bay can take some of that, you know, less than pristine kind of situation, but...
But it'd be nicer if it wasn't there.
It'd be nicer if the
Conowingo Dam didn't dump, you know, gazillion million tons of silt into the bay every year. I mean, it would just make it a better place.
Yeah.
So
I think people are trying, and that's the ones that, you know,
right.
that they see something and they want it fixed, and
right.
they want to fix it, and that's you know, it's good that people want to do that. You know, it's good that, you know, people are fearful for striped bass. I mean, that's not a bad thing.
It's right.
That,
we had a caller last week that said, well, with the striped bass are in trouble because there's no menhaden. Well, you know, I don't know if there's no menhaden, but they're here for a reason. They're here to spawn. They have to have something to eat. And, you know, they're not leaving here because there's no food. They're, you know, that's their nature. They spawn and they leave. You know, so.
I mean, there are menhaden out there. I mean, I don't want to get into, you know, discussing that whole point. But, I mean, there are some menhaden out there, and striped bass will eat other species.
Well, sure.
They will eat other fish. I mean, they're omnivores. They'll eat literally any other kind of fish that they come across if it will fit down their, you know, in their mouth.
They're opportunists. I mean,
exactly.
They'll eat spot.
Yeah.
They'll eat white perch. They'll eat spot-tail shiners. They'll eat bay anchovies. They'll eat silversides. They'll eat, you know. Hey, you know, if it tastes semi-good, they're going to eat it, you know.
So. I had a gentleman years ago bring me a, you know, something that he'd caught a striped bass it was like north of Broome's Island. It had a mouse in its stomach. He said, why did they eat that? And I said, well, the mouse went swimming, I guess.
Apparently.
We were just walking
around up here on shore one night, and there was a mouse, and, you know.
Something happened.
We were not saying why. But yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so. But they will eat. They'll change their, you know, I know on the coast as they, you know, they're heavily migratory. You know, if you sample them different areas along the coast, you'll think, oh, wow, their favorite food is squid.
Right.
Or, oh, their favorite food is menhaden. It depends on where they're at, because they will target, you know, we know they love eels.
Right.
They really do
no
love
question.
Eels. So
no question.
That's, you know, they're just kind of, it's kind of a neat critter.
Can we get them to like blue catfish and snakeheads?
I'm sorry?
Can we get them to like blue catfish and snakeheads?
They probably do. I mean, and probably on both ways. I mean,
yeah.
You probably see striped bass eating, you know, smaller snakeheads if they encounter them.
No question.
And then vice versa. The snakeheads certainly will probably eat a small striped bass, and anything else that, you know, happens to go by. Same thing with the catfish.
It's a wild world. Let's get back to some of the numbers here. And we're going to take a short break here in a minute. But let me ask you a question. We talked about the year classes and so forth. This year's fishery, what are we looking at as far as the sizes of the trophy fish, number one? And then number two, the 19-inch limit that you talked about, the 2011 and 2015 year classes, does success play into that?
Say that.
Okay. We have. What are the sizes of the trophy season fish? Are we still at 35 inches?
Yes. I'm sorry. The minimum size is still 35 inches.
Okay. And the minimum size in the summer fall fishery is going to be 2019. They're going to be 19.
It's going to be 19, right. Just like it was last year. You know, the circle hook use is still going to be promoted.
Right.
you know, we're still trying to work through some, public outreach, education with
right.
Serve a Hook work, trying to get folks to, you know, to, I mean, some folks had gotten on board. They're just still on the learning curve.
Right.
Last year in the trophy season, I mean, the average length of fish caught was almost 41 inches.
Right. And people need to know that there's still a governor's citation available for anybody that releases a fish over 40 inches.
Yes, yes.
You'll get a certificate signed by the governor.
Yes.
I think that's a little more valuable than a citation. That governor's citation says, hey, you're a conservationist. You caught this 40-inch fish and released it back into the bay to live another day and spawn. And, I mean, I think that's pretty significant that...
I think it more involves fishermen in the management, in the stewardship of the resource.
Right.
So you can enjoy it, you can, catch it, you can participate, and feel good about what you're doing.
Right.
Definitely. Yeah,
right.
Definitely.
Yep. So the second part of that question was, we had good spawns in 2011 and 2015. What size are those fish now here, 2019, 8 and 4 years later?
Well, the four-year-old fish, the 2015s, I mean, they're basically, you know, they're going to be in the fishery now in the coming, I don't want to say this.
You mean they're going to exceed the minimum size?
Right now they're probably like between 18 and 22 inches. I mean, again, depending on some grow faster than others.
Yeah.
But they're definitely going to be in the, like, once the regular season, once the trophy season goes out.
Right.
People will be able, there should be plenty of 19-inch fish out there.
Got it.
There should be plenty of fish out there.
Okay.
I know people are concerned, are we going to have, what's going to be out there? And, I mean, the younger fish, like the 2017 and 2018 fish that respond that were, above average year classes, they're, people may encounter some of the 17s, but they're all going to be sublegal. You're going to see lots of small fish.
Right.
But they're, we do have good year classes coming.
I got it. Okay.
Definitely.
Hey, we got to take a break. Hang on.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you.
All right. Hey, folks, if you want to catch a rockfish, I'm going to tell you where to go to get the stuff. The planer boards, are custom made. They can teach you how to use a planer board to troll for rockfish, and then they have the equipment that you use to troll for rockfish, including custom bucktails and parachutes and umbrellas. See, some of these are made in Maryland, like habanero custom baits and hardhead custom baits, all made right here in Maryland and all for sale. Habanero is exclusive at Chesapeake Outdoors. First choice for Eastern Shore hunters and anglers right across the Bay Bridge, exit 39B Dominion Road right there in Kent Island, Route 50 East. Now, Chesapeake Outdoors has Kent Island's largest selection of fishing and crabbing supplies. If you go in there and you look to the left, you're going to see a whole room full of fishing supplies for Chesapeake Bay, for tidal rivers, for freshwater fishing, a full selection of live and frozen bait as well, Yeti coolers to keep them in, Costa sunglasses to keep, keep your eyes nice and safe out there on the bright days. Make sure you're wearing one of their Chesapeake Outdoors t-shirts. And then if you like to fillet and release, well, they've got the Bubba Blade knives as well. So if it's striped bass coming up or any type of fishing, it's Chesapeake Outdoors. And don't forget, turkey season starts this week. They've got the shotguns and ammos, the calls, the decoys, and camo, including zinc calls and avian decoys and, Remington shotguns and others. So check them out. Chesapeake Outdoors, exit 39B. Dominion Road, Kent Island, Maryland, 410-604-2500, 410-604-2500. Now, here locally, another shop where you can go to get all the information you need for striped bass and all the equipment is Clyde's Sports Shop. They are ready to rock. They've got everything you need for trolling. They've got pen reels. They've got trolling combo rods, at really good prices. They've got anything you need to catch any type of fish in Maryland. You just have to go check it out. They'll do the rod and reel repair. They'll spool new line on your spools. They'll take care of any of your fishing, anything that you would want or desire for fishing and crabbing, Clyde Sport Shop has it at Clyde Sport Shop. 2307 Hammonds Ferry Road in Lansdowne. They're just off Beltway exit number 9. That phone number, 410-242-6108, 242-6108. Look at their website, Clyde's Sports, two S's in the middle, .com. This is Alan Ellis for Bay Linex of Glen Burnie and Catonsville Linex spray-on bedliners. Linex spray-on bedliners are rated number 1 and carry a nationwide lifetime warranty. A Linex spray-on bedliner completely seals out water, meaning no rust in your bed. Your tools, your tackle, crabbing, and hunting gear can't hurt it. Choose the Linex Premium or the Linex Extra. Both look great. Bay Linex and Catonsville Linex now offer truck gear, the toughest accessories for your truck. Step bars, tonneau covers, floor liners, grill guards, you get it. Bay Linex of Glen Burnie and Catonsville Linex provide the best protection for your truck. Protect your investment, your pickup truck, like I did with a Linex bedliner and truck gear accessories. Bay Linex of Glen Burnie, located at 201 Wholesome Way in Glen Burnie. 410-789-0199. 410-789-0199. Catonsville Linex, new location, 2076 Lord Baltimore Drive in Windsor Mill, just off Security Boulevard across from Coons Ford. 410-455-0800, 410-455-0800, Linex. Nothing is more frustrating than a dead battery. When your truck won't start or your boat or ATV leaves you stranded far from home, that's not good. The solution is Battery Warehouse. Not only does Battery Warehouse provide batteries for your car or truck, you can find marine batteries for cranking or trolling, ATV batteries, tractor batteries, motorcycle batteries, and batteries for all outdoors equipment. Did you know Battery Warehouse has batteries for wild game feeders, dog collars, cell phones, predator calls, and trail cameras? How about your video camera? Or if you tow your boat or trailer, your trailer brake control battery? Any battery you need. With 10 locations in Central Maryland, there's a Battery Warehouse convenient to you. Bel Air, Frederick, Cockeysville, Glen Burnie, Dundalk, Hagerstown, Westminster, Eldersburg, Parkville, and Woodlawn. Visit BatteryWarehouseMaryland.com online for the phone numbers and more information. When you need a hot flash, get to the Battery Warehouse near you. Hey, Bay Country Bakery in Cambridge has the most delicious fresh-baked donuts and pastries and cookies and breads on the Eastern Shore. Stop by and see the selection or grab some at the drive-thru. And you know what? Breakfast at Bay Country Bakery in Cambridge is served from 6 to 11 a.m. Monday through Friday on all day today, Saturday. When I'm on Route 50, I'm headed to the beach or the fishing grounds. My mouth, my belly is just watering and waiting to stop at Bay Country Bakery for a donut or a sandwich and a fresh cup of hot coffee. I just look for the big donut, the big pink sprinkled donut on the side of the bakery and a chocolate donut on the highway sign. And even after your morning adventure from 11 to 2, you can grab a tasty lunch. Your hosts are Dave and Gina Levy. They're trained chefs. They strive to bring you the very, very best. Bay Country Bakery, located at 2951 Coastal Highway. That's just through Cambridge on Route 50 East. Think big donut. Chris, you've seen the big donut, right? There you go. Visit their website. Like their Facebook page, Bay Country Bakery. Be sure to stop by. Say hello. Maybe you might see Robin and me there.
W&W Tire and Auto Service in Finksburg is taking care of my trucks for over 25 years. Anything from a simple oil change to extensive engine work, brakes, tune-ups, everything. Their motto is, we do it. Bridgestone and Firestone tires for pickups, SUVs, and commercial vehicles. Large trucks, motorhomes, even diesel engines are no problem. W&W Tire and Auto Service on Route 140, 3233 Baltimore Boulevard in Finksburg. Look for the big American flag. Call for an appointment, 410-833-8410. W&W Tire and Auto.
Snow and rain and bright sunshine.
dragging the line. That's what we do all trolling season, dragging the line. I guess some people like it. Let's talk to, we're talking with Harry Hornick, the striped bass head honcho there at DNR. And on the line, we must have said Beetlejuice three times or something, because here is Dale in Easton. Good morning, Dale. How are you?
Harry, contrary to what your host has told you, I did do a little bit of work. So.
What do you mean by that? I've never said you never worked.
Yeah, well.
Did I infer? Did I infer you never worked?
No. Harry, one of the other names, and you may have mentioned, I've kind of missed it, was Rudy Lukakovic. His work with Circle Hooks.
Oh, yeah.
Was second to none.
Definitely.
And
hi, Rudy.
One of the main reasons that we've got a 19-inch size limit is because of the work he did with Circle Hooks and Hook of Release Mortality. So he's, shout out to him.
He still is involved. I mean, I think most of you folks are, still have contacts at DNR, and I know Beth and Eric have spoken with Rudy, and Rudy comes to meetings and that. So no, I certainly didn't mean to leave him out. I know I would leave somebody out.
That's good.
Like I said, there were a lot of people have worked on striped bass over the years, and helped contribute
Harry,
to the
one other factor that is important with spawning success, and a lot of people don't realize this, isn't just pollution, but it's spring flows, water temperatures, and things like that. Because when those striped bass eggs hatch, that thing is just no more than two eyes and a wiggle.
Yeah.
And if you don't have good flows and water temperatures, they're not going to survive.
Oh, you can have all the spawning in the world, and
there you go.
If a bad episode weather flows.
Pulse thunderstorm.
Yep.
Yeah. It can destroy your ear class strength immediately. So, Harry, question I had was last year's trophy season. Do you happen to know what your ratio of pre-spawn to post-spawn fish were that you examined?
Hey, I'm the guy that throws the curveballs here.
Believe it or not, the majority of fish, 94% of the fish, were post-spawn last year.
That's cool. That's good.
And it's been actually going up. I mean, at the very beginning of the season, we have people calling and said, hey, I just caught this fish that was full of eggs. It was busting at the seams. And, some people let them go. Some people keep them. Mm-hmm. But as you get later on in the season, you start seeing people start seeing fish that were post-spawn, and by the end of the season, like I said, it's really last year it was I think 6% were pre-spawn, and those are fish that were caught early in the season.
Right.
But 94%, like over the whole season, were post-spawn. They had spawned, they were downrunners, people caught them, because they were hungry and feeding and everything.
Right. Right. I understand.
Again, that number has it keeps rising. I think in a couple of years ago it was like 88%.
That sounds to me like good news. Is that good news?
It is. Yeah, it is definitely. And
okay.
Like I said, this past year, 94%. Like I said, it keeps creeping up.
In layman's terms, what happened is that by the time the trophy season opened, there were only a few fish remaining that hadn't spawned, and as we went further into the season, the catch of the pre-spawn fish that hadn't spawned yet has diminished dramatically, and that the fish that we took out of the, ecosystem were the ones that have already done the deed, and their eggs survived anyway.
Right.
Or for the most part, I mean, we were hoping for their survival.
So the only problem with Alan, with you, when you have and the question that I've and Rudy and I have talked about was stress in reeling those fish in.
Yeah.
Pre-spawn fish and then release. I mean,
that's my pick with the catch and release season.
Yeah, because again, you don't know what I mean. You can be as careful as possible, but there's no way of knowing the stress you put on that fish.
Right.
Whether that fish is going to successfully spawn or abort the eggs or whatever. So.
Well, I think Rudy did that. I think Rudy did that survey, and the overall kind of conclusion was that as long as the water temperature is low.
Below a certain level, correct.
Yeah, below a certain level, then the stress is less on the fish than if it were, you know, in the last couple of days where we've had these 80-degree temperatures. Now, whether that affected water temperature or not, we don't know. You know, what happened to the well, you know, because you take the water temperature, you know. It rose, 12 or something degrees over in the course of a week.
These warm jags in here, it doesn't take much.
Right.
Harry, now that we've talked about that stripe thing, what about the real fish? What about the clutes?
They last week, Simon Brown on our staff on the Potomac River said he saw some of the biggest American shad that he had ever seen up on the spawning grounds encountered in the striped bass survey. He said there's a lot of them.
Good.
You know, we don't have actual numbers, but like I said, he was very, very excited, you know, to report what he had seen over there, you know, mixed in with the striped bass and white perch.
There you go.
Really nice American shad, big ones.
I've had an unofficial report from a guy who fishes Fletcher's, and he's seen fish, good number of fish at Fletcher's.
Has he seen any of the big ones? Has he mentioned that, or?
How big is a big American shad? A big American
anything,
shad.
I don't know, Alan. Anything over 4 pounds is a pretty good American shad.
Okay.
You'll get fished 5, 6, maybe 7 pounds occasionally.
Right.
So.
Well, I had when I fished with you on some of the surveys, Dale, on Conowingo, I had to catch a fish over a certain amount of
500 millimeters.
500 millimeters to get a hat.
Fork length. That's correct.
And how long is 500 millimeters?
Oh, I don't know, 23 inches.
Okay.
Approximately, just to guess.
All right. So. You scientists do everything in millimeters, you know, not like the rest of us Americans out here. But that's okay. It's a universal language.
Yeah. But it's like right about 20 inches is 500 millimeters.
Yeah.
And I think Simon was saying they were, you know, they were bigger than that. They were a little bit bigger,
Nice fish.
Kind of neat.
Harry, what about hickory shad? Have you seen any, I mean, I know it's a fairly incidental catch, but I'm just curious.
I think that the Upper Bay folks had seen some.
I was going to ask what Beth has seen up there.
Yeah. What's that again, sir?
What Beth has seen up there, has she seen anything in the Upper Bay?
Yes, I think that's where they saw them, I think, was in the Upper Bay.
Okay.
Yeah, I hadn't heard anything. Yeah, Simon didn't mention, you know, over on the Potomac there, but, you know, just other than it was the American shad, so.
Right.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
I know they do, they definitely show up on the Upper Bay. I know, you know, the folks up there see them.
I did speak with somebody yesterday or day before that said that Deer Creek has not seen an influx just yet of the hickories. There's not a lot of guys up there fishing for them, and they're not catching a tremendous amount on Deer Creek. But, some of the other rivers seem to have started with the hickories, Dale, as you well know.
Harry, I trust your son and daughter are out of harm's way.
Yes, they are. They're still in uniform and enjoying their work. Kind of exciting for them. Nervous for his parents. They're both their parents. So,
right. Sure.
Thank you for asking about them.
All right. Harry, take care and just remember, keep your head down.
Yep.
All right.
All right.
Hey, Dale. Thanks, buddy. Coffee this week, maybe.
I'll catch you.
Take care. Thank you.
See you, man. Thanks. There goes Uncle Dale. Good. Always, Dale's the shad guy.
He is.
It doesn't matter what kind.
He has worked with striped bass.
There's no question.
Yep,
you know,
definitely.
and you know, there's any number of people that are involved in that fishery because it is one of the most important fisheries, if not the most important fishery here in Maryland. I mean, you know, that's why people buy licenses every year so to catch big striped bass.
Speaking of people that work with striped bass, I want to give a shout out to our Marine Police folks that are also out there doing a little different job, but still very important, and
making sure the regulations are enforced.
Right, and then keeping people safe. So
exactly, No question.
Appreciate their work.
Yep, we got to stay safe on the water. Yeah. No question. So, all right, what's the next question, Harry? I've kind of lost track here. Where do you want to go? What do you want to talk about?
People may be interested to know that, you know, there's fish are on the spawning grounds now. Fish have been spawning, not that you can catch them and keep them next week in the chop tank.
Right.
Folks have seen some of our habitat folks that conduct work over there. They've been seeing, striped bass eggs and larvae.
Right.
The temperature's a little bit warmer there. And again, in the Upper Bay, I mean, folks, the striped bass folks up there are seeing, you know, a few big females and lots of small males, and you know, they're still on the spawning grounds. So
sure.
Those fish will, you know, once they spawn, they do move pretty quickly. I think they get out of town. You know, they're hungry. They you know, they want to start their migration back, you know, back to the coast and everything.
Sure, they get the munchies after they smoke their cigarette, and then away they go.
And go on to the rest of their life.
Exactly. Sure.
I we talked about what people are hearing. They heard the M word. They heard, you know, closures and things.
Yeah.
And, I mean, once the Atlantic States Marine Fisheries Commission meets in May, April, May, the end of the month, end of April.
Yeah.
You know, we'll know more about what kind of things may be coming down the road. I mean, what will happen is they'll have, you know, the scientists with the ASMSC and the scientists of all the different states are going to have, you know, they're going to have a list of options like, hey, this is what we think will bring, you know, we'll change this track in spawning stock abundance. You know, we'll change the fishing mortality rates. And what those are going to be, I don't know. I mean, the states, each state will be, will have some options, and they'll, you know, and like in Maryland's case, you know, we'll sit down with all the user groups, you know, the Sport Fish and Tidal Fish Advisory Commissions, the CCA, you know, the sportsmen's groups.
Right.
And it's going to be, you know, there's going to be a discussion. I mean, people, you know, no decisions are going to be made in a vacuum. People are going to, you know, get to look and see,
right,
you know, what their options are going to be. And, you know, we're going to try to do the best we can, you know, balancing, you know, management and conservation and, you know, letting people enjoy a sustainable resource. You know, we're going to try to do the best we can.
Isn't that the key, though, the sustainable resource you manage conservatively to make sure that we do have a sustainable resource?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it's with any species of wildlife. You know, you have to take in the fluctuations of the environmental conditions and harvest rates and everything else that affects our natural resources. And, you know, a commercial harvest is a big part of that as well. So you got to deal with that end of it. We're talking primarily recreational. So,
yeah.
You know, there's a whole other element there that has their own constituency and their own advocacy groups that you know have a big effect, maybe more so politically than management wise, but you know, that there's that element there when you're catching these fish to make money off of them. You know, it's always, where do you balance the charter boat the group? Are they commercial fishermen or are they recreational fishermen? They're taking recreational fishermen, you know, six at a time out there in the Chesapeake Bay to catch rockfish to make money.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so where does the charter boat guy fit? The commercial guy, he's out there to catch as many fish towards his quota that he can catch to make money on them. So, and the recreational guy's out there kind of caught and like, okay, well, I just want to catch a rockfish, you know. So, I mean, you got a lot of balls in the air. You guys got a lot to balance here in Maryland, especially. So, and you multiply that by the number of states on the Atlantic States Marine Fisheries Commission and, you know, all the elements that go into that, you know, and this highly mobile migratory resource. Man, somebody's got to do it, and it's hard work. There's no question about it.
Oh, as you said, it's plate juggling or ball juggling or plate spinning.
Yep.
I've never, ever been bored at DNR, which...
Well, that's a good thing.
Great people.
Yeah.
Working with some really great people, and there's folks there that, I mean, they're up for it. I mean, it'll be a challenge, but, I mean, again, the stock itself is again, we're concerned about the slope, you know, that the changes in abundance,
right,
of the spawning stock, but... You know, in this past year, I mean, in the trophy season last year, there were 13 different age classes of fish harvested.
Wow!
You know, between 7 and 19 years old, and our survey, the survey that's being conducted on the Potomac River and the Upper Bay, I mean, we encountered 18 different age classes of fish.
But that's a good thing.
You know, and that's great news. I mean, because you didn't see that pre-moratorium. You did not see that kind of a, like an age structure, you know, the distribution of the ages within, you know, within the population and within the fishery itself. So, you know, we have a lot of good things, going for us. I mean, the stock is, you know, I've heard people say collapse, and it's like we're nowhere near anything like that.
Okay, let's put it this way.
Yeah.
If 100 was the best possible number that we could have for Chesapeake and for striped bass in the Chesapeake Bay, where were we 10 years ago? Where were we when we hit the 100, and that, where are we now?
Well, we hit the 100 probably in the mid-2000s at the peak of all the, you know, highest harvest. You know, people were catching their quotas. I mean, everybody, I mean, it's kind of crazy because a lot of people don't remember anything before that.
Right.
They don't remember building up, you know, the reopening of the seasons in 1990 that, you know, were very short, abbreviated, you know, very limited harvest. You know, people really upset, you know, they couldn't go fishing because they missed the season.
Right.
And then it got to the point where, you know, again, like in the mid 2000s, 2006, I think was like one of the highest.
Right.
And then it's just kind of dropped a little, you know, dropped or kind of leveled off. And then in the last few years, it's, you know, there's like kind of a negative slope in harvest and in spawning stock abundance. But I would still say we're still in the
good old days.
We're still in the 80s, 89 to 90s as far as grades. That's what I'm going to venture.
89 to 90, that's pretty good.
Not a 99 like in 2006, but we're still, I mean, we have some work to do to level that out.
You have a pretty good grade point average.
But, you know, we're still not doing bad.
Got it.
Not doing bad. I mean, it's a healthy population.
Yeah.
You mentioned commercial fishermen and charter boat guys. You know, the charter boat folks, I mean, they're providing a service to other recreational fishermen.
No question.
May not be able to get out.
Yep.
The commercial fishermen, they're providing a service to, you know, when my father, when he was alive, and to my brothers and sisters that don't fish, they're providing a service to them. You know, they're providing this resource to folks that don't go fishing.
Yeah,
but still like to have fish. So
yep, hang on.
There's enough for everybody. It's just, you know, it's a pie, and we gotta figure out
divvy up the pie. Hang on a minute, Tackle Box. Tim Sherman wants to ask you a question.
Okay,
hold on. Tim, good morning.
Good morning, Al. Good morning, Harry. How are you?
Good morning. How are you
today? Hey, last year when we did the seasons, summer fall season, the size limit was June to October. And it was 19 inches. And there wasn't a whole lot put out about the size increase from October to December. Is this year going to be all the way through June to December, 19 inches?
My understanding is it should be the same. It should go all the way through December.
Okay.
The 19 inch.
I have a couple of friends who got caught in the not knowing category of size change in October. So it'd be nice to have just the same rules all season long.
I mean, I can forward that information, you know, to make sure we get the news out. I mean, I know there's folks that work in our public communications that, you know, Facebook and Twitter and news releases, press releases, things like that, that we can make sure that it's, you know, to clarify that for anglers.
Yeah, it would also be nice just to get the word out to tackle shops when the guys stop in that they can remind the anglers of, hey, don't forget to, If there will be a change, hey guys, don't forget it might be 20 now instead of 19. Like
there you go. All right, Tim, appreciate that. We got to take our final break and get out of here for the next guy to be on the air. So thank you. Thanks, Tim.
Bye bye.
See you, buddy. Bye bye. Okay, we got to take a break, Harry, and we'll be right back to you to say your final words of wisdom there, if you will.
Okay.
Okay?
All right. Thank you.
Got it. Chesapeake Outdoors is located just down the road here off of Route 50, exit 39B. That's Dominion Road. Everything for rockfish. And since we're stressed on time here just a little bit, I'm just going to say they have everything for every type of fishing and everything for every type of hunting. So if you need it, go to where the anglers and hunters on the Eastern Shore go for their hunting and fishing supplies. Expert advice, top-notch equipment, and, you know, you name it, they've got it at Chesapeake Outdoors. So check that out, 410-604-2500, exit 39B on Kent Island, right off Route 50. You name it, they've got it for fishing, crabbing, and hunting. It's Chesapeake Outdoors. Keep that in mind. Then, On this side of the bridge, we got Clyde Sports Shop. Clyde Sports Shop is located at 2307 Hammonds Ferry Road in Lansdowne. They're just off Beltway Exit 9. Same thing on this side of the bridge. All the rod and reel repairs, all the bait, all the tackle, everything for Rockfish. You'll get in there this week and get geared up and ready to go, fresh line and the whole deal. Of course, they have the full line gunsmithing as well. So, Clyde Sports Shop, 2307 Hammonds Ferry Road, 410-242-6108. Now it's time to tell you about Papa John's, owned by the Schillinger family. If you enjoy gardening and just like having pretty flowers around, Schillinger's Papa John's Farm in Severn, just off I-97. Papa John's greenhouses have annuals by the pack or flat, perennials by the pot, bedding plants, planters, hanging baskets, colorful pansies, impatiens, petunias, and much, much more, and the proven winter specialty plants. All the vegetable plants, too, at Papa John's, ready to plant in your home garden. Tomatoes and squash and onions and watermelon, cantaloupe and hot peppers and herbs. Papa John's Farm, located just off I-97, exit 12, 8029 New Cut Road in Severn. Drive right to the greenhouse to make your selections or give them a call, 410-969-5909. They are experts. Think about flowers and plants from Papa John's for your garden or for your church. Easter's next Sunday. Mother's Day coming soon, May 12th. Call 410-969-5909. Papa John's is open every day. Visit Schillinger's Papa John's Farm. It'll grow on you.
Weakening cold front continues to push through today, and any showers will be limited to the early part of the day. We'll work in some clearing in the latter part of our Saturday. We'll see some early patchy fog hit the mid to upper 70s. And then tonight the clouds build in, rain moves in, maybe some thunder, overnight lows, mid to upper 50s. I'm Jeff Eno for the Weather Channel for Talk Radio 680 WCBN.
Alan Ellis here for Catonsville Linex and Bay Linex of Glen Burnie spray-on bedliners. Linex spray-on bedliners rated number one, carrying nationwide lifetime warranty. Linex spray-on bedliner completely seals out water, meaning no rust in your bed. Your tools, your tackle, your crabbing and hunting gear can't hurt your truck bed. Choose the Linex premium bedliner or the Linex Extra. Both look great. And Catonsville Linex and Bay Linex now offer truck gear, the toughest accessories for your truck, step bars, tonneau covers, floor liners, grill guards, you get it. Catonsville Linex and Bay Linex of Glen Burnie provide the best protection for your truck. Protect your investment, your pickup truck, like I did with a Linex spray-on bedliner, truck gear, and accessories. Catonsville Linex, new location, 2076 Lord Baltimore Drive in Windsor Mill, just off Security Boulevard across from Coons Ford, 410-455-0800. That's 410-455-0800. Bay Linex of Glen Burnie, located at 201 Wholesome Way in Glen Burnie. Call 410-789-0199. That's 410-789-0199. Linex.